5. They were rowed back to the lower docks of the Savrola in a long gig with a covered gallery. It was nearly dawn, and a watery orange light was coming up over the land side of Talvarar, peeking over the islands and making their seaward faces seem darker by contrast. Surrounded by the Archon's oarsmen and watched by four eyes with crossbows, Locke and Jean said nothing. Their exit was quick. The boat simply drew up to the edge of one deserted quay, and Locke and Jean hopped out. One of the Archon's soldiers threw a leather sack out onto the stones at their feet, and then the gig was backing away, and the whole damnable episode was over. Locke felt a strange daze, and he rubbed his eyes, which felt dry within their sockets. "Gods," said Jean, "we must look as though we've been mugged." "We have been." Locke reached down, picked up the sack, and examined its contents. Jean's two hatchets and their assortment of daggers. He grunted. "Magi! God's damned bonds, Magi!" This must be what they had in mind. "I hope it's all they have in mind." "They're not all-knowing, Locke. They must have weaknesses." "Must they really? And do you know what they are? Might one of them be allergic to exotic foods or suffer poor relations with his mother? Some good that does us, when they're well beyond dagger reach. Crooked warden, why don't dogs' assholes like Stragos ever want to simply hire us for money? I'd be happy to work for fair pay." "No, you wouldn't." "Feh. Quit scowling and think for a moment. You heard Stragos report. The Bonds Magi knew about the preparations we've made for going after Requin's vault, but they didn't know the whole story, the important part." "Right, but what need would there be for them to tell Stragos everything?" "None, of course. But also, they knew where we were operating from in Camor, but he didn't mention our history. Stragos spoke of Barsavi, but not chains. Perhaps because Chains died before the Falconer ever came to Camor and started observing us? I don't think the Bonds Magi can read our thoughts, Locke. I think they're magnificent spies, but they're not infallible. We still have some secrets." "Forgive me if I find that a cold comfort, Jean. You know who waxes philosophical about the tiniest weaknesses of enemies? The powerless. You seem resigned to that without much of a..." "I'm not resigned, Jean. I'm angry. We need to cease being powerless as soon as possible." "Right. So where do we start?" "Well, I'm going to go back to the inn. I'm going to pour a gallon of cold water down my throat. I'm going to get into bed, put a pillow over my head, and stay there until sunset."
"I approve."
"Good. Then we'll both be well rested when it comes time to get up and find a black alchemist. I want a second opinion on latent poisons. I want to know everything there is to know about the subject, and whether there are any antidotes we can start trying."
"Agreed."
"After that, we can add one more small item to our agenda for this Talvarar holiday of ours."
"Kick the Archon in the teeth?"
"Gods, yes," said Locke, smacking a fist into an open palm. "Whether or not we finish the Requin job first, whether or not there really is a poison, I'm going to take his whole bloody palace and shove it so far up his arse he'll have stone towers for tonsils."
"Any plans to that effect?"
"No idea. I've no idea whatsoever. I'll reflect on it, that's for damn sure. But as for not being rash, well, no promises."
Jean grunted. The two of them turned and began to plod along the quay toward the stone steps that would lead laboriously to the island's upper tier.
Locke rubbed his stomach and felt his skin crawling, felt violated somehow, knowing that something lethal might be slipping unfelt into the darkest crevices of his own body, waiting to do mischief. On their right, the sun was a burning bronze medallion coming up over the city's horizon, perched there like one of the Archon's faceless soldiers, gazing steadily down upon them. Reminiscence,
The Lady of the Glass Pylon. 1. Azura Galadin was not an easy woman to speak to. To be sure, hers was a well-known title, second mistress of the great guild of artificers, reckoners, and minutiary artisans, and her address was common knowledge, the intersection of Glassbender Street and the Avenue of the Cogscrapers, West Cantezzo, 4th tier, Artificers Crescent. But anyone approaching that home had to walk 40 feet off the main pedestrian thoroughfare. Those 40 feet were one hell of a thing to contemplate. 6 months had passed since Locke and Jean had come to Talvarar. The personalities of Leocanto Costa and Jerome de Ferra had evolved from bare sketches to comfortable second skins. Summer had been dying when they'd clattered down the road toward the city for the first time, but now the hard, dry winds of winter had given way to the turbulent breezes of early spring. It was the month of Saris, in the 78th year of Nara, the plague-bringer, mistress of ubiquitous maladies. Jean rode in a padded chair at the stern of a hard luxury scull, a low, sleek craft crewed by 6 rowers. It sliced across the choppy waters of Talvarar's main anchorage like an insect in haste, ducking and weaving between larger vessels in accordance with the shouted directions of a teenage girl perched in its bow. It was a windy day, with the milky light of the sun pouring down without warmth from behind high veils of clouds. Talvarar's anchorage was crowded with cargo lighters, barges, small boats, and the great ships of 12 nations. A squadron of galleons from Emberlane and Parley rode low in the water with the aquamarine and gold banners of the Kingdom of the 7 Marrows fluttering at their sterns. A few hundred yards away, Jean could see a brig flying the white flag of Lachaine, and beyond that, a galley with the banner of the Marrows over the smaller pennant of the Canton of Balinel, which was just a few 100 miles north up the coast from Talvarar. Jean's skull was rounding the southern tip of the Merchant's Crescent, one of 3 sickle-shaped islands that surrounded the Castellana at the city's centre like the encompassing petals of a flower. His destination was the Artificer's Crescent, home of the men and women who had raised the art of clockwork mechanics from an eccentric hobby to a vibrant industry. Verari clockwork was more delicate, more subtle, more durable, more anything as required, than that fashioned by all but a handful of masters anywhere else in the known world. Strangely, the more familiar Jean grew with Talvarar, the odder the place seemed to him. Every city built on Eldrin ruins acquired its own unique character, in many cases shaped directly by the nature of those ruins. Camori lived on islands, separated by nothing more than canals, or at most the Angevine River, and their existence was shoulder to shoulder compared to the great wealth of space Talvarar had to offer. The 100-odd thousand souls on Talvarar's seaward islands made full use of that space, dividing themselves into tribes with unusual precision. In the west, the poor clung to spots in the portable quarter, where those willing to tolerate constant rearrangement of all their belongings by hard sea weather could at least live free of rent. In the east, they crowded the Istrian district and provided labor for the tiered gardens of the Black Hands Crescent. There they grew luxury crops they could not afford, on plots of alchemically enriched soil they could never own. Talvarar had only 1 graveyard, the ancient Midden of Souls, which took up most of the city's eastern island, opposite the Black Hands Crescent. The Midden had 6 tiers, studded with memorial stones, sculptures, and mausoleums like miniature mansions. The dead were as strictly sifted in death as they'd been in life, with each successive tier claiming a better class of corpse. It was a morbid mirror of the golden steps across the bay. The Midden itself was almost as large as the entire city of Velverazzo, and it sported its own strange society. Priests and priestesses of Azaguia, gangs of mourners for hire, all of whom would loudly proclaim their ceremonial specialties or particular theatrical flourishes to anyone within shouting distance, mausoleum sculptors, and the oddest of all, the Midden Vigilants. The Vigilants were criminals convicted of grave robbery. In place of execution, they were locked into steel masks and clanking scale armor, and forced to patrol the Midden of Souls as part of a sullen constabulary. Each would be freed only when another grave robber was captured to take his or her place. Some would have to wait years. Tal Verar had no hangings, no beheadings, and none of the fights between convicted criminals and wild animals that were popular virtually everywhere else. In Tal Verar, those convicted of capital crimes simply vanished, along with most of the city's garbage, into the Midden Deep. This was an open square pit, 40 feet on a side, located to the north of the Midden of Souls. Its elderglass walls plunged into absolute darkness, giving no hint as to how far down they truly went. Popular lore held that it was bottomless, and criminals prodded off the execution planks usually went screaming and pleading. The worst rumor about the place, of course, was that those thrown down into the deep did not die, but somehow continued falling, forever.
"Hard larboard!" cried the girl at the bow of the Skull.
The rowers on Jean's left yanked their oars out of the water, and the ones on the right pulled hard, sliding the craft just out of the way of a cargo galley crammed with fairly alarmed cattle. A man at the side rail of the galley shook his fist down at the Skull as it passed, perhaps 10 feet beneath the level of his boots.
"Get the shit out of your eyes, you underground cunt! Go back to pleasuring your cattle, you soft-dicked cur! You bitch! You cheeky bitch! Heave to and I'll show you who's soft-dicked! Begging your pardon, gracious sir!"
Seated in his throne-like chair, dressed in a velvet frock coat with enough gold fripperies to sparkle even in the weak light of an overcast day, Jean looked very much a man of consequence. It was important for the man on the galley to ensure that his verbal salvos were accurately received. While they were an accepted part of life on the harbour in Tal Verar, the moneyed class were always treated as though they were somehow levitating above the water, entirely independent of the vessels and labourers carrying them. Jean waved nonchalantly.
"I don't need to get any closer to know it's soft, lard cock."
The girl made a rude gesture with both hands.
"I can see how disappointed your fucking cows are from here."
With that, the Skull was out of range of any audible reply. The galley fell away to the stern, and the southwestern edge of the artificer's crescent grew before them.
"For that," said Jean, "an extra silver Volani for everyone here."
As the increasingly cheerful girl and her enthusiastic team pulled him steadily toward the docks of the Artificer's Crescent, Jean's eyes were drawn by a tumult on the water a few hundred yards to his left. A cargo lighter flagged with some sort of Verari Guild banner Jean didn't recognize was surrounded by at least a dozen smaller craft. Men and women from the boats were trying to clamber aboard the cargo lighter, while the outnumbered crew of the larger vessel attempted to fend them off with oars and a water pump. A boat full of constables seemed to be approaching, but was still several minutes off.
"Now what the hell's that?" Jean yelled to the girl.
"What? Where? Oh, that! That's the Quillpen Rebellion, up to business as usual."
"Quillpen Rebellion?"
"The Guild of Scribes. That cargo boat's flying a Guild of Letterpressers flag. It must be carrying a printing press from the Artificer's Crescent. You ever seen a press?"
"Heard of them. For the first time just a few months ago, in fact."
"The scribes don't like 'em. Think they'll put their trade out of business. So they've been running ambushes when the letterpressers try to get one across the bay. There must be 6 or 7 of those new presses on the bottom of the water by now, plus a few bodies. It's a big, fat, weeping mess, you ask me."
"I'm inclined to agree."
"Well, hopefully they won't come up with anything that can replace a good team of honest rowers. Here's your dock, sir. Quite a bit ahead of schedule, if I'm correct. You want us to wait around?"
"By all means," said Jean. "Amusing help is so hard to find. I expect I won't be but an hour."
At your service, then, Master de Ferra.
2. The Crescent was not exclusive to the great guild of artificers, though it was where the majority of them chose to settle, and where their private halls and clubs loomed on virtually every street corner, and where they were most tolerated in their habit of leaving incomprehensible and occasionally hazardous devices out in plain sight. Jean made his way up the steep steps of the Avenue of the Brass Cockatrice, past candle merchants and blade sharpeners and veni pacifers, mystics who claimed to be able to read the full sweep of someone's destiny from the pattern of blood vessels visible on their hands and forearms. At the top of the avenue he dodged away from a slim young woman in a four-cornered hat and sun veil, walking a Valcona on a reinforced leather leash. Valcona were flightless attack birds, larger than hunting hounds. With their vestigial wings folded back along their stout bodies, they hopped about on claws that could tear out fist-sized chunks of human flesh. They bonded like affectionate babies to one person, and were perfectly happy to kill anyone else in the entire world at any time.
"Good killer bird," muttered Jean. "Pretty threat to life and limb. What a lovely little girl or boy or thing you are."
The creature chirruped a little warning at him and scampered after its mistress. Huffing and sweating, Jean made his way up another set of switchback stairs and made an irritated mental note that a few hours of training would do his spreading gut some good. Jérôme de Ferra was a man who viewed exercise solely as a means of getting from bed to the gambling tables and back again. 40 feet, 60 feet, 80 feet, up from the waterfront, up the second and third tiers of the island, up to the fourth and topmost, where the eccentric influence of the artificers was at its strongest. The shops and houses on the fourth tier of the crescent were provided with water by an extremely elaborate network of aqueducts. Some of them were the stones and pillars of the Therin Throne era, while some were merely leather chutes supported by wooden struts. Water wheels, windmills, gears, counterweights, and pendulums swung everywhere Jean looked. Rearranging the water supply was a game the artificers played amongst themselves. The only rule was that nobody's supply was to be cut off at the point of final delivery. Every few days, a new offshoot of some duct or a new pumping apparatus would appear, stealing water from an older duct or pumping apparatus. A few days later, another artificer would divert water through another new channel, and the battle would continue. Tropical storms would invariably litter the streets of the crescent with cogs and mechanisms and ductwork, and the artificers would invariably rebuild their water channels twice as strangely as before. Glassbender Street ran the full length of the topmost tier. Jean turned to his left and hurried along the cobbles. The strange smells of glassmaking wafted out at him from shop fronts. Through open doors he could see artisans spinning glowing orange shapes at the ends of long poles. A small crowd of alchemist's assistants brushed past him, hogging the street. They wore the trademark red skull caps of their profession and displayed the chemical burns along their hands and faces that were their badges of pride. He passed the avenue of the cog scrapers, where a small crowd of labourers were seated before their shops, cleaning and polishing pieces of metal. Some were under the direct scrutiny of impatient artificers, who grumbled unhelpful directions and stamped their feet nervously. This intersection was the southwestern end of the fourth tier. There was nowhere else to go except down, or out along the 40-foot walk to the home of Azura Galadin. At the cul-de-sac end to Glassbender Street was an arc of shop fronts with one gap like a tooth knocked out of a smile. Jutting beyond this gap was an elderglass pylon, anchored to the stone of the fourth tier for some unfathomable eldrin reason. The pylon was about a foot and a half wide, flat-topped and 40 feet long. It speared out into the empty air, 15 yards above the rooftops of a winding street down on the third tier. The house of Azura Galadin was perched at the far end of that pylon, like a three-story bird's nest on the tip of a branch. The second mistress of the great guild of artificers had discovered an ideal means of assuring her privacy,
Only those with very serious business or very sincere need of her skills would be mad enough to scamper out along the pylon that led to her front door. Jean swallowed, rubbed his hands together, and said a brief prayer to the crooked warden before stepping out onto the elderglass.
"It can't be that hard," he muttered. "I've been through worse. It's just a short little walk. No need to look down. I'm as steady as a laden galleon."
With his hands held out at his sides for balance, he began to make his way carefully across the pylon. It was curious how the breeze seemed to pick up as he crossed, and how the sky seemed suddenly wider above him. He fixed his eyes firmly on the door before him, and, unbeknownst to himself, ceased to breathe until his hands were planted firmly on that door. He gasped in a deep breath and wiped his brow, which had sprung an embarrassing quantity of sweat. Azura Galadine's house was solidly crafted from white stone blocks. It had a high-peaked roof crowned with a squeaking windmill and a large leather rain-collection bladder in a wooden frame. The door was decorated with relief carvings of gears and other clockwork mechanisms, and beside it a brass plate was set into the stone. Jean pressed the plate and heard a gong echoing within the house. Smoke from cook fires below curled up past him while he stood there waiting for some response. He was about to press the plate again when the door creaked open. A short, scowling woman appeared in the gap between the door and its frame, staring up at him. She had to be on the downside of 60, Jean thought. Her reddish skin was lined like the joints of an aged leather garment. She was heavy-set, with a vaguely frog-like bulge of flesh at her throat and jowly features drooping like sculptor's putty from her high cheekbones. Her white hair was tightly braided with alternating rings of brass and black iron, and most of the visible flesh on her hands, forearms, and neck was covered in elaborate, slightly faded tattoos. Jean set his right foot before his left and bowed at a 45-degree angle, with his left hand flung out and his right tucked beneath his stomach. He was about to start conjuring verbal flowers when Guild Mistress Galadine seized him by his collar and dragged him into her house.
"Ow, madam, please! Allow me to introduce myself!"
"You're too fat and well-dressed to be an apprentice after patronage," she replied, "so you must be here to beg a favour. And when your kind says hello, it tends to take a while. No, shut up!"
Her house smelled like oil, sweat, stone dust, and heated metal. The interior was one tall hollow, the strangest cluttered conglomeration Jean had ever seen. There were man-sized arched windows on the right-hand and left-hand walls, but every other inch of wall space was taken up with a sort of scaffolding that supported 100 wooden shelves crammed with tools, materials, and junk. At the top of the scaffolding, set atop a makeshift floor of planks, Jean could see a sleeping pallet and a desk beneath a pair of hanging alchemical lamps. Ladders and leather cords hung down in several places. Books and scrolls and half-empty corked bottles covered most of the floor.
"If I've come at a bad time..."
"It's usually a bad time, young master interloper. A client with an interesting request is about the only thing that ever changes that. So what's it to be?"
"Guild Mistress Galadine, everyone I've asked has sworn that the most subtle, most accomplished, most imitated artificer in all of Tal'Varar is none other than your..."
"Quit bathing me with your flattery, boy," said the old woman, waving her hands. "Look around you. Gears and levers, weights and chains. You don't need to lick them with pretty words to make them work, nor me."
"As you wish," said Jean, straightening up and reaching within his coat. "I couldn't live with myself if I didn't extend one small courtesy, however."
From within his coat he brought forth a small package wrapped in cloth of silver. The neat corners of the wrapping were drawn together beneath a red wax seal, stamped into a curled disc of shaved gold. Jean's informants had all mentioned Galadine's single human failing, a taste for presents as strong as her distaste for flattery and interruptions. She knitted her eyebrows, but did manage a ghost of an anticipatory smile as she took the package in her tattooed hands.
"Well," she said, "well, we must all certainly be able to live with ourselves."
She popped the disc seal and pried the cloth of silver apart with the eagerness of a little girl. The package contained a brass-stoppered rectangular bottle filled with milky white liquid. She sucked in her breath when she read the label.
"White plum Osterschalen," she whispered. 12 gods! Who have you been speaking to?"
Brandy mixes were a Talvarar peculiarity. Fine brandies from elsewhere, in this case the peerless Osterschalen of Emberlane, were mixed with local liquor from rare alchemical fruits, and there were none rarer than the heavenly white plum, then bottled and aged to produce cordials that could blast the tongue into numbness with the richness of their flavour. The bottle held perhaps 2 glasses of white plum Osterschalen, and it was worth 45 solari. "A few knowledgeable souls," said Jean, "who said you might appreciate a modest draught."
"This is hardly modest, master."
"De Ferra, Jerome de Ferra, at your service."
"Quite the opposite, Master de Ferra. What did you want me to do for you?"
"Well, if you'd really prefer to get to the nub of the matter, I don't have a specific need just yet. What I have are questions."
"About what?"
"Vaults." Guildmistress Galadine cradled her brandy mix like a new baby and said,
"Vaults, Master de Ferra? Simple storage vaults with mechanical conveniences, or secure vaults with mechanical defences?"
"My taste, madam, runs more toward the latter."
"What is it you wish to guard?"
"Nothing," said Jean. "It is more a matter of something I wish to unguard."
"Are you locked out of a vault, needing someone to loosen it up a bit for you?"
"Yes, madam. It's just..."
"Just what?"
Jean licked his lips again and smiled. "I had heard, well, credible rumours that you might be amenable to the sort of work I might suggest." She fixed him with a knowing stare.
"Are you implying that you don't necessarily own the vault that you're locked out of?"
"Huh. Not necessarily, no." She paced around the floor of her house, stepping over books and bottles and mechanical devices.
"The law of the Great Guild," she said at last, "forbids any one of us from directly interfering with the work of another, save by invitation or at the need of the state."
There was another pause.
"However, it's not unknown for advice to be given, schematics to be examined, in the interest of advancing the craft, you understand? It's a form of testing to destruction. It's how we critique one another, as it were."
"Advice would be all that I ask," said Jean. "I don't even need a locksmith. I just need information to arm a locksmith."
"There are few who could better arm such a one than myself. Before we discuss the matter of compensation, tell me, do you know the designer of the vault you've got your eyes on?"
"I do."
"And it is?"
"Azura Galadine." The guildmistress took a step away from him, as though a forked tongue had suddenly flicked out between his lips.
"Help you circumvent my own work? Are you mad?"
"I had hoped," said Jean, "that the identity of the vault owner might be one that wouldn't raise any particular pangs of sympathy."
"Who and where?"
"Requin, the Sin Spire."
12 gods, are you mad?"
Galadine glanced around as though checking the room for spies before she continued.
"That certainly does raise pangs of sympathy. Sympathy for myself."
My pockets are deep, guild mistress. Surely there must be a sum which would alleviate your qualms.
There is no sum in this world, said the old woman, large enough to convince me to give you what you ask for. Your accent, Master de Ferra, I believe I place it. You're from Talisham, are you not?
Yes.
And Requin, you've studied him, have you?
Thoroughly, of course.
Nonsense. If you'd studied him thoroughly, you wouldn't be here. Let me tell you a little something about Requin, you poor, rich Talishani simpleton. Do you know that woman of his, Selendri, the one with the brass hand?
I've heard that he keeps no other close to him.
And that's all you know?
More or less.
Until several years ago, said Galadine, it was Requin's custom to host a grand masque at the Sinspire each day of changes. A mad revel in 1,000 Solari costumes, of which his were always the grandest. Well, one year he and that beautiful young woman of his decided to switch costumes and masks on a whim. An assassin, she continued, had dusted the inside of Requin's costume with something devilish, the blackest sort of alchemy, a kind of aqua regia of human flesh. It was just a powder. It needed sweat and warmth to bring it to life. And so that woman wore it for nearly half an hour, until she'd just begun to sweat and enjoy herself. And that's when she started to scream. I wasn't there, but there were artificers of my acquaintance in the crowd, and they say she screamed and screamed until her voice broke, until there was nothing coming from her throat but a hiss, and still she kept trying to scream. Only one side of the costume was doused with the stuff, a perverse gesture. Her skin bubbled and ran like hot tar. Her flesh steamed, Master de Ferra. No one had the courage to touch her, except Requin. He cut her costume off, demanded water, worked over her feverishly. He wiped her burning skin clean with his jacket, with scraps of cloth, with his bare hands. He was so badly burned himself that he wears gloves to this day to hide his own scars.
Astonishing, said Jean.
He saved her life, said Galadine. What was left of it to save? Surely you've seen her face. One eye evaporated like a grape in a bonfire. Her toes required amputation. Her fingers were burnt twigs. Her hand a blistered waste. It had to go as well. They had to cut off a breast, Master de Ferra. I assure you, you can have no conception of quite what that means. It would mean much to me now, and it has been many long years since I was last thought comely. When she was abed, Requin passed the word to all of his gangs, all of his thieves, all of his contacts, all of his friends among the rich and the powerful. He offered 1,000 Solari, no questions asked, for anyone who could give him the identity of the would-be poisoner. But there was quite a bit of fear concerning this particular assassin, and Requin was not nearly as respected then as he is now. He received no answer. The next night, he offered 5,000 Solari, no questions asked, and still received no answer. The third night, he repeated his offer for 10,000 Solari, fruitlessly. On the fourth night, he offered 20,000, and not one person came forward. And so the murders started the very next night, at random, among the thieves, among the alchemists, among the servants of the priori, anyone who might have access to useful information. One a night, silent work, absolutely professional. Each victim had his or her skin peeled off with a knife on their left side, as a reminder. And so his gangs and his gamblers and his associates begged him to stop. "Find me an assassin," he told them, "and I will." And they pleaded, and they made their inquiries, and came back with nothing. So he began to kill 2 people per night. He began to kill wives, husbands, children, friends. One of his gangs rebelled, and they were found dead the next morning, all of them. He tightened his grip on his gangs and purged them of the weak-hearted. He killed and killed and killed until the entire city was in a frenzy to turn over every rock, to kick in every door for him, until nothing could be worse than to keep disappointing him. At last, a man was brought before him who satisfied his questions. "Requin," said Galadin with a long, dry sigh, "set that man inside a wooden frame, chained there on his left side. The frame was filled with alchemical cement, which was allowed to harden. The frame was tipped up, so you see the man was half sealed into a stone wall all along his left side, from his feet to the top of his head. He was tipped up and left standing in Requin's vault to die. Requin would go in himself and force water down the man's throat each day. His trapped limbs rotted, festered, made him sick. He died slowly, starving and gangrenous, sealed into the most perfectly hideous physical torture I have ever heard of in all my long years." "So you will forgive me," she said, taking Jean gently by the arm and leading him toward the left-hand window, "if Requin is one client with whom I intend to maintain absolute faith until the Lady Most Kind sweeps my soul out of this old sack of bones."
"But surely there's no need for him to know."
"And just as surely, Master de Ferre, there is the fact that I would never chance it. Never."
"But surely a small consideration..."
"Have you heard," interrupted Galadin, "of what happens to those caught cheating at his tower, Master de Ferre? He collects their hands, and then he drops them onto a stone courtyard and bills their families or business partners to have the bodies cleaned up. And what about the last man who started a fight inside the Sinspire and drew blood? Requin had him tied to a table. His kneecaps were cut out by a dog leech, and red ants were poured into the wounds. The kneecaps were lashed back down with twine. That man begged to have his throat slit. His request was not granted. Requin is a power unto himself. The Archon can't touch him for fear of aggravating the Priori, and the Priori find him far too useful to turn on him. Since Selendri nearly died, he's become an artist of cruelty, the likes of which this city has never seen. There is no mortal reward that I would consider worth provoking that man."
"I take all that very seriously, madam. So can we not carefully minimize your involvement? Settle for a basic schematic of the vault mechanisms, the most general overview, the sort of thing that could never be specifically tied to you?"
"You haven't really been listening."
She shook her head and gestured toward the left-hand window of her house.
"Let me ask you something else, Master de Ferre. Can you see the view of Tal Verar out this window?"
Jean stepped forward to gaze out through the pane of glass. The view was southward, over the western tip of the Artificer's Crescent, across the anchorage and the glimmering silver-white water to the Sword Marina. There the Archon's navy rode at anchor, protected by high walls and catapults.
"It's a very lovely view," he said.
"Isn't it? Now, you must consider this my final statement on the matter. Do you know anything of counterweights?"
"I can't say that I..."
At that moment, the guild mistress yanked on one of the leather cords that hung down from her ceiling. The first notion Jean had that the floor had opened up beneath his feet was when the view of Tal Varar suddenly seemed to move up toward the ceiling. His senses conferred hastily on just what this meant, and were stumped for a split second until his stomach weighed in with nauseous confirmation that the view wasn't doing the moving. He plunged through the floor and struck a hard square platform suspended just beneath Galadine's house by iron chains at the corners. His first thought was that it must be some sort of lift, and then it began to plummet toward the street 40-odd feet below. The chains rattled, and the sudden breeze washed over him. He fell prone and clung to the platform with white-knuckled alarm. Roofs and carts and cobblestones rushed up toward him, and he braced himself for the sharp pain of impact. But it didn't come. The platform was slowing down with impossible smoothness. Sure death slowed to possible injury, and then to mere embarrassment. The descent ended a bare few feet above the street, when the chains on Jean's left stayed taut while the others went slack. The platform tilted with a lurch and dumped him in a heap on the cobbles. He sat up and sucked in a grateful breath. The street was spinning slightly around him. He looked up and saw that the chain platform was rapidly ascending back to its former position. A split second before it drew home into the underside of Galadine's floor, something small and shiny tumbled out of the trapdoor above it. Jean managed to flinch away and cover his face just before glass shards and liquor from the exploding bottle of brandy mix sprayed over him. He wiped a good few solari worth of white plum Osterschalen out of his hair as he stumbled to his feet, wide-eyed and cursing.
"A fine afternoon to you, sir. But wait, don't tell me. Let me guess. Proposal not accepted by the guild mistress?"
Jean, befuddled, found a smiling beer-seller not 5 feet to his right, leaning against the wall of a closed and unmarked two-story building. The man was a tanned scarecrow with a broad-brimmed leather hat that drooped with age until it nearly touched his bony shoulders. He drummed the fingers of one hand on a large wheeled cask, to which several wooden mugs were attached by long chains.
Something like that, said Jean.
A hatchet slipped out of his coat and clattered against the cobblestones. Red-faced, he bent, retrieved it, and made it vanish again.
"You might call this self-serving, and I'd certainly be the first to agree with you, sir. But you look to me like a man in need of a drink. A drink that won't bust open against the cobbles and damn near break your skull, that is."
"Do I? What have you got?"
"Burgle, sir. Presuming you've heard of it, it's a Ferrari specialty, and if you've had it in Talisham, you haven't had it at all. Nothing at all against Talishani, of course. Why, I've got family in Talisham, you know."
Burgle was a thick, dark beer, usually flavoured with a few drops of almond oil. It had a kick comparable to many wines. Jean nodded.
"A full mug, if you please."
The beer-seller opened the tap on his cask and filled one of the chained mugs with liquid that looked almost black. He passed this to Jean with one hand and tipped his cap with the other.
"She does it a few times a week, you know."
Jean quaffed the warm beer and let the yeasty, nutty flavour flow down the back of his throat.
"A few times a week?"
"She's a mite impatient with some of her visitors. Doesn't wait to terminate conversation with all the usual niceties. But then you knew that already."
This is pretty tolerable stuff."
"Thank you kindly, sir. One centira the full mug. Thank you kindly. I do a brisk business with folks falling out of Madame Galadine's floor. I usually try to stake this spot out just in case it rains a customer or two. I'm very sorry you didn't find satisfaction in your meeting with her."
"Satisfaction? Well, she might have gotten rid of me before I expected, but I think I did what I set out to do."
Jean poured the last of the beer down his throat, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, and passed the mug back.
"I'm really just planting a seed for the future, is all."